Hi guys.
Hello.
Welcome back
to the Flick Chicks podcast.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Jane.
And how are you, Jane?
I'm doing all right. You know, the world is wild. So the Trump rally just happened in Tulsa.
Yes.
And there were only 6,200 people there.
Hilarious.
Pink sold out that same location in 5 minutes.
Pink. Not even like all that relevant anymore.
I know, but like still sold out.
Still way more relevant than our president.
Yes.
And
how are you?
Good. That was hilarious.
Yeah, so funny. I'm
gonna laugh.
Yeah, we
to
both
my grave about that.
We both reserved tickets.
Oh, I reserved tickets
and didn't go. So
amazing.
It was an amazing work of activism.
It was like, good job, everyone.
Yes.
We did it. We
all came together.
Single-handedly sold over 1 million tickets. And 6,000 people showed up. 6,000 of those tickets were real. So, great job, everyone. Yeah, I'm good. We got a new cat.
Yes.
Super sweet.
Sterling and Elliot.
So sweet. I mean, they're not getting along, but...
They'll get along.
They'll get along eventually.
They'll be fine.
We're working on it.
Yes.
And they're doing better. So, yeah, we didn't record last week. Because we thought we might have COVID, so we decided to.
Yeah, we were scared, so we were like,
let's not see each other in case one of us has it and the other one doesn't.
Yeah, but.
But we don't have it, so, yeah, so here we are.
Here we are.
We're good. Yeah, so we actually watched this movie, Malcolm X is the movie.
Yeah, by Spike Lee.
We watched it last week?
Last week,
like,
yeah.
I guess 2 weeks
last
ago.
Last Saturday.
Yeah, by the time this comes out, it'll have been like 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, because we just, our previous episode that we have uploaded is Selma.
Yes.
So this one is, we decided to do Spike Lee's Malcolm X.
Since we were already kind of on the topic.
Topic of Malcolm X a bit.
Yeah, we were talking about him in our Selma episode. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we wanted to learn more and, you know, really interested because I grew up in a really small town and, you know, really small high school.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously all of the history courses were taught by football coaches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And not that all football coach, teachers are bad, but mine were particularly terrible.
But mine were.
And they, like, they portrayed Malcolm X as, like, a terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, mine too.
Yeah. And, like, they also told me that slavery wasn't that bad because... Quote, white people took care of the black people.
Yeah, they sure took care of them.
They sure took care of them by murdering them and raping them.
They sure took care of them, all right?
Yeah.
Well, the same way I take care of those, you know what I mean? Yeah, one time when I was in a junior in English, this kid in my class was like, you know, slavery wasn't that bad. They had food and a shelter and a job. And I was like, job.
A job that they didn't get paid for or time off from.
I was like, oh, yeah. Job.
You mean slavery?
I was like, oh, how would you like a job where you just work for me, no questions asked, and I could do whatever I want to, and also you get no money.
You get no money. No one's looking after you.
But you get to live. But hear me out. I'll put you up in a shack with a dirt floor.
And then I'll whip you.
Hear me out. I'll beat you when you don't do what I want. But I'll put you in a shack with dirt floors, and I'll give you some bread. It's like, how's that deal sound to you? Sweet? No.
I'm a pretty sweet deal.
I mean, what's the issue, right? You get food and shelter. What else do you need? I don't know.
Maybe basic human rights?
Fulfillment? No. Yeah, so she made us watch documentaries on the horrors of slavery for, like, weeks after that. And I was like, good for her.
Good for her. That's a really good idea.
Because at the very least, even if you didn't learn anything, you did shut the fuck up about it forever.
Yeah, exactly. Now you will never talk about that
now
again.
Now you'll never mention that around me again. So I guess one way or another it works out, doesn't it?
Someone wins.
Someone wins. And if you learned something, awesome. And if you didn't, I don't care. Because either way, you're still never going to bring it up again. And you can no longer claim ignorance either.
True.
But, yeah, I also was taught the same thing, that Malcolm X was, like, a terrorist,
mm-hmm.
and that he hated white people and wanted to, like, decimate the white race.
Yeah. And then we watched this movie.
Which is sort of the exact opposite of what was true.
Yeah, that's not what he wanted to do at all.
Let me take a little sip of my drink.
Okay.
So, this movie, first of all. 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours. We, like, had to pause.
We did not know that.
No, we didn't. And we paused halfway through and then, like, just ranted about the state of the world.
We ranted about the state of the world for, like, an hour, and then we still had another hour left. And we were like, oh, crap. We're going to just get more mad. We have to keep going. So, yeah. Yep. Malcolm X.
Malcolm X.
What did you learn? Nothing good. So, here's the thing. Here's what I think is interesting about Malcolm X in particular. Is, like, he gets such a bad rep. Oh, this is something that's interesting. So, the reason. You want to know the reason we learn this, basically?
Yeah, the reason we learn, like, that he's a terrorist?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to find the Wikipedia page, but it keeps bringing me to Malcolm X, the real person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what? Early life? That's not what I want. Yeah, but basically, he, like... So, the way that textbooks are made... There's only, like, 2 states in the entire United States that make textbooks.
Okay.
For all public schools. Pretty much all schools in general.
Mm-hmm.
One is in California, and one is in Texas.
Yikes.
So, the way that the textbooks are made are literally like this. California makes all the textbooks that go to, like, the coast. And that go to, like, really large cities. And, like, really democratic areas. And then Texas makes all the textbooks that go to red states, basically.
1984!
So, basically, like, they write... The way that each of them write history either has, like, a more, I guess, like, democratic or I would call it authentic view of history.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Texas versions have, like, more... whitewashed versions of history, and mm-hmm. those are the ones that are sent out.
And that's the ones that we got.
Yeah, because we live in red states. So, that was something I learned recently.
That's really upsetting.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's, like, not to say that the California textbooks are perfect either, because obviously California textbooks leave out a lot of things, like...
Definitely.
The Tulsa race riots, like, that's a huge thing. I mean, there's literally a huge thing on Twitter right now where people are like, here's stuff that you never learned in history class. And it's like, nobody in any history class in all of America or the world learned about it.
Yep.
So...
Maybe it's a problem with our education.
Maybe it's like, nobody's writing about it. But definitely, like, the one of the biggest things is, like, the Civil War is, like, one of the most... obviously rewritten for the states things.
Definitely.
Like, red states, the Civil War is, like, comes across as, like, this, like, I mean, not that, like, no textbook can be, like, slavery wasn't a part of the Civil War at all. Like, obviously you can't write that because yeah. It's just so blatantly false.
So not but true.
They, like, red state textbooks really perpetuate the idea of, like, the lost cause myth.
Yeah.
And then, like, blue state textbooks really, like, are more like, slavery was the cause of the Civil War.
Slavery was bad, and it needed to end.
It was more like, slavery was the cause of the Civil War, like, the end.
Yeah.
End all, be all. Like, which is true. I mean, people are like, it was about states' rights, and like,
states' rights to what?
State rights to what? And they're like, to make their own laws. Regarding what? Slavery. So, you know, the lost cause myth. My friend, at her 21st birthday, our friend, is going to be doing drunk history. We are all going to get drunk, and then we all have to come with a historical event
yes.
to tell to the group. So I am going to be telling the story of the Lost Cause myth and how it came to be.
I love
and
that.
So I'm like excited to...
I love that. That's so exciting.
That'll be cool. So anyway, let's talk about this movie a bit.
Yes.
Plot. Malcolm Little is raised in a poor household in rural Michigan by his Caribbean mother and African-American father. When Malcolm is a young boy, their house is burnt down and his father, an activist for black rights, is killed by a chapter of the Black Legion. His death is registered as a suicide and the family receives no compensation. Even though, by the way, he was bashed in the back of the head and put on train tracks.
Yeah, because you can totally kill yourself by blunt force trauma to the back of your head.
Suicide. Oh my god, what was I literally listening to a Crime Junkie episode today about this girl. Really recent case. It's been all over Twitter. I just can't remember her name right now. I'm going to look it up. Oh, Tamala Horsford?
Yes, I've heard about her. I haven't listened to the episode yet.
So it basically was... This girl, she's like 40, mm-hmm. She had a birthday party, her 40th birthday. She had a bunch of her friends over, And they had, like, a sleepover, and she they were all really drunk, and basically, like, she goes out to the balcony, and the next morning, they, like, she was like, oh, I'm gonna go out for a cigarette, because everyone was, like, going to sleep, and she was like, I'm going out for a cigarette, and nobody, like, kind of paid attention. I guess they were all drunk, they fell asleep, whatever, and the next morning, somebody found her when they were leaving on, or, like, on the balcony. She had fallen off and was, like, dead, and, so at first, it just looks like, oh,
she fell off.
Yeah, it looks like a really tragic accident. Like, she fell off, she was drunk, whatever. But then, like, they do the autopsy, and they find that she died of multiple blunt force trauma wounds.
Oh, my God.
Not from, like, falling off a balcony. Oh,
that's so scary.
So, like, some people are obviously, like, asking some questions here about, like, well, what, like, what is this? And basically, like, eventually the state just ruled it, like, it is an accident. Like, all her wounds are consistent with her falling off a balcony. But then, like, another private person came in and basically found that, like, her wounds are more consistent with, like, her body being thrown off a balcony after death. Like, that a lot of the minor injuries she sustained would have been from her being thrown off after death. But the blunt force trauma was probably from, like, being beaten. And she, it's, like, really interesting because she's, like, a, she lives in a town where the black population's only, like, 2% or something like that. And, like, every single person at the party was white. Really weird. Like, there's, like, it's really weird. It's really recent. So they're reopening the case. Because of the, like, public interest. But
definitely.
I was like, this is very similar to what happens here. He bludgeoned himself in the back of the head, and then he sat down on some train tracks to die. He tied He tied himself to some train tracks.
It's just so ridiculous.
And then he committed suicide.
That's so...
So...
Oh, my God.
Malcolm's mother's mental state deteriorates, and she is admitted into a mental institution after her children are taken away. Malcolm and his siblings are put into protective care. Malcolm performs well in school and dreams of being a lawyer, but is discouraged by his teacher due to his skin color.
Very upsetting.
Very upsetting. In 1944, Malcolm, now a teenager, lives in Boston. One night, he catches the attention of the white Sophia. That's a weird way to...
The white Sophia.
A weird way to talk about her. A white woman named Sophia. Is probably what I would have written. Because there's not a black Sophia in the movie either. No. It's just the white one, so... also, he's dating a girl.
Yeah, he's already dating this girl.
Yeah. Whose name I can't remember, but she's black. The black blank. And the two begin to date. Malcolm travels to Harlem with Sophia. At a bar, he meets West Indian Archie, a gangster who runs a local game numbers game. The two become friends and start cooperating in a legal numbers racket. One night at a club, Malcolm claims to have bet on a winning number. Archie disputes this, denying him a large sum of money. The conflict ensues between the two, and Malcolm returns to Boston after an attempt on his life. Malcolm, Sophia, Malcolm's friend Shorty, played by Spike Lee, and a woman named Peg decide to perform robberies to earn money. Mm-hmm. By 1946, the group has accrued a large amount of money from thievery. However, they are later arrested. The two girls are sentenced to 2 years as first offenders in
connection... The two white girls.
Yeah, the two white girls are sentenced to 2 years as first offenders in connection with the robberies, while Malcolm and Shorty are sentenced to 8 to 10 years in jail.
But they can't, yeah.
Well, yeah, so
they're sentenced to, like, a lot
like
of eight.
Like, 14 to... counts each 8 to 10 years of robbery, but they serve them concurrently. So they only have to serve one of the terms, basically. So it means, like, if you're serving concurrently, it means they're serving a minimum of 10 years.
Yeah.
While incarcerated, Malcolm meets Baines, a member of the Nation of Islam, who directs him to the teaching of the group's leader, Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm grows interested in the Muslim religion and lifestyle promoted by the group and begins to resent white people for their maltreatment of his race. So, that's a really gentle way of putting this. So, basically, the guy, Baines, the way he kind of gets him interested is he says, like, this is just like Christianity, except that it's, like, more accurate in the way that, like, it celebrates people of color as, like, the people who are in the Bible, which is, like, accurate, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Everyone in the Bible is a person of color. So, that's obviously something that, like, nobody's taught, especially, like, here in America.
Definitely. It's all whitewashed.
It's all whitewashed because, like, back in the Renaissance, like, people whitewashed the paintings and now that's what we do. So, he kind of becomes attracted to this idea of, like, yeah, you know, like, they would have all been POC. Like, that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. it does make sense. And then, obviously, the Muslim religion has other teachings other than Christianity. They believe, like, that they have prophets right now, which is, yeah. like, Elijah Muhammad is their prophet currently. And back then as well.
Yeah.
So they kind of, he kind of becomes more attracted to this idea mainly because of the idea that, like, white people have been hurting black people for, like, centuries, and that, like, Islam is the only religion that is for people of color.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, like, that's kind of why he's attracted to it, if that makes sense. Like, definitely. Over another religion is because he feels like this is the only religion that's for people of color.
Yeah. And this wasn't mentioned in there, but he, like, has this thing where he kind of wants to, like, appear more white. Like, mm-hmm. he, like, straightens his hair, even yeah. though it's, like, really painful.
And it is horrible. Yeah, and it discolors his hair for, like, the rest of his life.
Yeah, it makes it turn red. That's why people call him red. Called mm-hmm. him red at first.
Yeah, because his hair was red. Yeah, really, any, like, he dresses, like, really, I don't know, jivey, I think is the word yeah. that you should describe him. So, yeah, not great. Malcolm is paroled from prison in 1952 after serving 6 years and travels to the Nation of Islam's headquarters in Chicago. There, he meets Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad, by the way, who instructs Malcolm to replace his surname Little with X, which is symbolic of his lost African surname that was taken from him by white people. He is rechristened as Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. Malcolm returns to Harlem and begins to preach the nation's message. Over time, his speeches gather large crowds of onlookers.
Amazing public speaker.
Yo, a great public speaker.
Incredible. And Denzel Washington does a really good job oh, yeah. of capturing that, oh, yeah. too.
Malcolm proposes ideas such as African-American separation from white Americans. In 1958, Malcolm meets with nurse Betty Sanders. The two begin dating, quickly marry, and become parents of 4 daughters. Several years later, Malcolm is now in a high position as the spokesperson of the Nation of Islam. During this time, Malcolm learns that Muhammad had fathered numerous children out of wedlock in contradiction to his teachings in Islam. Obviously, this movie is 3.5 hours, so this is a very short... A lot happens in yeah. that paragraph. A lot of the movie is that. A lot of the movie is that. Like, so much of the movie is yes. that paragraph. Yeah, Malcolm kind of particularly obviously targets African-American people kind of with this idea that, like, why are you with their religion when, like, this religion believes in you?
Mm-hmm.
And he does agree with segregation.
But I think it comes from a very understandable place.
Yeah, I mean...
Because it's like, what have white people ever done for black people?
Yeah, it's still not great. I don't love the idea of, like, oh, let's segregate. But I definitely yeah. see where it comes from because in his mind, the way he wants it is he just... It's like... White Americans already don't want you here,
yeah.
but they also don't want you to succeed. Like, by being a part of the white, being under a white government, basically in his mind, being under a white government is stopping you from having financial success. So if they were a completely black-run, like, nation, they would be able to support only each other's businesses,
mm-hmm.
support, you know, only, like, live with their free, like, natural hairstyles.
Kind of like Black Wall Street in Tulsa.
Exactly.
Before, like, it was yes, destroyed.
Exactly. And that's, like, that's what he's kind of on about,
it's like a
right?
self-sustaining society.
It's a self-sustaining, like, the same way that, I mean, this is, like, a big thing in Jewish communities, too, that a lot of Jewish people only try to only patronize other Jewish shops.
Yeah.
Because it really helps out the community. It, like, supports your local community. And that's just kind of the same idea, but he's basically saying... Even if we segregate ourselves in this nation, we'll never be able to do that because white people won't let it happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's kind of right. But mm-hmm. Still, obviously, like, not really the move anyone else is going for during this time.
Yeah.
He's kind of the only person going for this move. But it really speaks, it resonates with a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think it makes sense.
Yeah, like, I mean, the logic is there. I definitely understand it, even if I don't think it's, like, the solution.
Yeah.
I understand that it is a solution.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so Muhammad basically
slept with all these women who were, like, clerk, like under, like, interns. That's yeah. what they were. And, you know, he has that power, and so it's kind of like that abuse of power. And yeah. Malcolm and also, doesn't really like that.
Also, it's definitely against the teachings, like,
Like, you're not supposed to be an adulterer.
You're not supposed to have sex with people out of wedlock. And they're like, obviously, this is, like, true in Christianity as well, but, like, obviously it's a lot more serious in Islam. You're not allowed to do that. Like, you're going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
But, you know, first, Malcolm X doesn't believe it, but then he goes and visits the women.
And they, like, talk about how much they love him and how they just want him to, like, recognize that these children are his.
And they want to, like... have him, they want him to financially support, but he won't, basically.
Yeah, he won't take responsibility for it.
So that kind of makes Malcolm...
disillusioned with the whole movement.
Yes. So after U.S. President John F. Kennedy is assassinated in November 1963, Malcolm comments that the assassination was a product of the white violence that had been prevalent in America since its founding, comparing the killings to chickens coming home to roost. And he also does say, like, in the statement that he's, of course, sad about it. He doesn't think it's right.
Yeah.
But that he thinks that it was going to happen always.
Yeah. Yeah.
He basically says it was inevitable. That's what he basically says. Says it's sad, but it's inevitable. And it's because of the violence that you have sown that you're seeing it coming back. Which, like, now we know is probably the government. But, or an accident.
Yeah, or an accident.
It was either an accident or it was planned by the government.
Definitely. So, it wasn't just Lee Harvey Oswald.
No. This statement damages Malcolm's reputation, and Muhammad suspends him from speaking to the press or at temples for 90 days.
He is not happy.
So, basically, he leaves the church.
Yep.
And in early 1964, Malcolm goes on a pilgrimage to Mecca, where he finds Muslims from all races, including white. Malcolm, having lost his faith in the Nation of Islam, publicly announces that he is founding the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which teaches tolerance instead of racial separation. Mm-hmm. He is exiled from the Nation of Islam, and his house is firebombed in early 1965. Yeah, so basically...
And he talks a little bit about how he wants to, at first, have his church be black only, so they can build their own community, and then they'll welcome in white people as allies.
He basically says, like, I'm willing to work with speakers like Martin Luther King Jr., like, if they're willing to work with me, I've said bad things, they've said bad things about me, but I'm willing to forgive them, I want them to be willing to forgive me. And he basically says, a lot of my views were told to me. Mm-hmm. By this church, and now that I'm not working with them, I can have my own views, and this is what I think.
And I'm just gonna say, I think it was a little culty, but also I think that most organized religions are a little culty.
Oh yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Nation of Islam is fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, like, clearly a very dangerous organization, but at the same time, like, so is the Catholic Church.
So is the Catholic Church. So is the KKK.
The Catholic Church literally has killed people. So.
So to cover up child molestation. So
this is, I mean, like, it's not that unheard of, right?
For religions to, like, be that way.
Especially, like, Malcolm X is someone that was so, it would be like if the Pope literally quit. I mean, not the Pope, because that's, like, Elijah Muhammad, but, like, let's say, like, the Archbishop or something.
Just straight up quit and then was like. Quit
and then was like. Releasing all the secrets about the Pope to the fucking press. Like, the Pope is coming for you.
Yeah, they would not take that.
No. So, it's a really, like, similar situation to that, and obviously they have a lot more of a violent, I don't want to say, like, violent religion, because that's not really true, but...
Their group has, like, violent inclination.
Yes, they're more willing to accept the violence, for sure. And they, and another thing is, like, earlier in the movie... There is a scene where this woman, like a white woman, comes up to Malcolm X at university and she basically says, you know, I've read all your stuff and I totally agree with you and I want to know, like, what can I do as a white person to help you out? And he basically says nothing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like how he felt, was like, white people can't do anything to help us. I don't want any help from white people at all. But he later, like, changes his mind on that and he says, you know, right now... Black people need to learn to love themselves before we can accept help from you. And you can never be a part of this because you're not black.
Yeah, but you can support.
Yeah, you can support and you can give money and you can do all these things that you can educate your white friend. Like, basically, same thing people are saying now.
Yeah.
He's saying then. So, yeah. But yeah, they firebomb his house with his children inside.
Pretty upsetting. And his wife.
But they all live. They all get out.
Mm-hmm.
So on February 21st, 1965, Malcolm prepares to speak before a crowd at the Audubon ballroom in Harlem before he is shot several times by the disciples of the Nation of Islam. One of the shooters, Thomas Hagen, is shot in the leg by one of Malcolm's bodyguards and beaten by a furious crowd. Malcolm is transported to the hospital but is pronounced dead on arrival. The film concludes with a series of clips showing the aftermath of Malcolm's death. Martin Luther King Jr. delivers a eulogy to Malcolm and Ossie Davis recites a speech at Malcolm's funeral. Nelson Mandela delivers a speech to a school, quoting an excerpt from one of Malcolm's speeches. Yeah, so...
And I like how they use the real footage at the end.
Yeah, that's much better. We really appreciate it. Thanks, Spike. Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a really short synopsis of a really long
movie. Really long movie, yeah.
So there's a lot... That's basically the high points, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of that's just expounded upon, so you get... It really is, like, kind of a sense of Malcolm's character.
Yeah, it's like a portrait of a man, pretty much.
Which is really, it's interesting because, you know, you kind of grow up thinking, like, oh, Malcolm, he hates white people and all this stuff. And you're like, well, sort of, but that's not really the whole picture.
That's not really...
And when you know, like, the history behind his life.
Yeah.
And how his entire life was ruined by white people.
Yes.
And then, historically, the lives of black people have been ruined by white people. It's kind of like you understand where he's coming from, even if you don't necessarily agree with all his points.
Yeah.
And then again, like, something they never tell you in school is that later in life, and I only say later in life because he was killed so prematurely.
Yeah.
But... Later in his life, he turned away from all of that and was much more, like, literally like a Martin Luther King Jr.
He wanted to be more tolerant.
Yeah. And, like, even Martin Luther King Jr., like, I've said this so many times, and I'll say it again. Martin Luther King Jr. himself was, like, Malcolm and I had different approaches, but without either of us, the other one wouldn't have made any difference.
Exactly. It's the foot in the door effect.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like, without Malcolm X's extremism, people wouldn't have listened to Martin Luther King Jr. Or it would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah.
And at the same time, like, without Martin Luther King Jr., like, where would Malcolm X have had to go?
Yeah.
Nowhere. Like, and the fact that Malcolm X even writes a letter to his wife at one point, and they read it, and he basically says, like, you know, I think I'm wrong about all this racial segregation stuff. Like, I saw that, you know, love unites people and that these other speakers, these other people, they're right and I was wrong.
Yeah.
Like, he was very upfront.
And he was like, I met white Muslims who, like, I genuinely cared about and wanted to, you know, be a part of my life.
Yeah. And he came to say, like, you know, I know that that I was wrong. And it's like, that only seems like such a small part of his history, but you have to understand he was only 40. Like, if he hadn't been killed,
exactly,
who knows, like, what he would have done? Who knows what he would have done for the fight?
Definitely.
Like, he was, in my opinion, Malcolm X is, like, a much stronger presence than Martin Luther King Jr.
I agree.
Like, people, he never really had any police run-ins. Like,
he never incited, not that Martin Luther King Jr. didn't, but he also never incited violence.
Yeah. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. and... Malcolm X were both big proponents of, like, the idea that black people should defend themselves and that they should be armed and stuff like that. Whereas, like, you look at, like, Gandhi. Gandhi was like, don't ever perpetuate violence against them, even if they're, like, beating you to death. Don't do anything. That was not Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was like, if they're beating you up,
defend yourself.
But, and Malcolm X was kind of the same. Malcolm X, I think, used more intimidation than Martin Luther King did.
He's just such, like, a presence.
Yeah, Malcolm X definitely had the threat of violence on his side. Whereas people knew Martin Luther King Jr. is never going to threaten that violence.
Yeah.
But I think really the only difference between Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, like, when you actually come down to it, is, like, their views on what should be done. Malcolm X had a lot more of an extreme view, but again, like, later in his life, he scaled that back a lot.
Yeah.
And Martin Luther King Jr., later in his life, again, also cut very short, he said, like, my views were maybe a little naive. Like, I should have been a little bit more extreme in what I thought. Like, I was a little naive to think that people would just, like, roll over and be like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Like,
you kind of have to fight.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where it's, like, he gets such a bad rep, but it's because he's, like, killed. How's he supposed to ever make up for what he did?
Exactly.
And also, there's a really... One of my favorite little moments in the movie So J. Edgar Hoover is obviously in charge of the FBI at this point.
He's the worst.
And we know that he, if you listen to Selma episode or if you just know history, he is obviously listening to Martin Luther King Jr. and interfering in his life a lot. J. Edgar Hoover seems like he didn't interfere as much in Malcolm X's life, maybe because of the threat of the Nation of Islam, maybe because he didn't see him as much of a threat. But he was definitely listening to him.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where these two FBI guys...
Oh my gosh, this is so good.
They're listening to a conversation Malcolm X is having with his wife where she's like, we miss you. And he's like, I miss you, I love you, but you can't come see me, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. All this stuff. And they look up and they said, man, compared to Dr. King, this guy's like a saint.
Yeah.
Because it's like that idea that it's like... That idea is so funny because you learn about him and he's like this black devil that hated white people.
Exactly.
And then it's like... Compared to Dr. Luther King, like Martin Luther King Jr. personally.
In his personal life?
A much better husband.
Yes.
A much nicer person. But like, on his belief spectrum, a lot more extreme.
And people just demonize that.
Yes. Also, I do want to bring up this point because the movie does kind of bring it up. It's kind of like a short bit in the movie, but Malcolm X is kind of a misogynist for sure.
Yeah.
I think that he becomes less of that in his life.
Definitely.
Once he gets with his wife.
But when he first meets his wife, he's like... Do you know, like, what it takes to be a wife of a man of Islam or something like that? And she's like, well, I've been told that I'm tall, that I'm short enough for a tall man and, like, stuff like that. And, you know,
yeah, like,
he wants her to stay home.
He treats Sophia very poorly.
Yeah.
He treats his other girlfriend very poorly. And it's also very interesting, Malcolm X, he's with Sophia. And I think it's very clear that Sophia loves him very much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she never betrays him. She never does anything to him badly. Like, she never does anything bad to him at all.
Yeah.
Except that when she gets out of prison after 2 years, she marries a white guy for money.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, okay. I mean, yeah.
Society.
Society. She never really does anything to him wrong, but he's always very distrustful of her.
Yeah.
He always thinks she's, like, sleeping around. His girlfriend before her, he's very awful to. He cheats on her. Like, he is a misogynist. And honestly, I think that's one of the largest things that drew him to Islam initially, probably. Like, one of a huge thing that probably drew him was the fact that his misogyny was kind of justified in that religion,
yeah,
along with what he already kind of thought about white people. And on top of that, I mean, you have to understand, like, Islam reformed his life.
Yeah.
Islam turned his entire life around. He was a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
He was a thief. He was a gang. Like, he was basically, like, in the mob almost.
Yeah.
And he completely transforms his life, right?
Yeah.
Because he
becomes one of the greatest civil rights leaders,
yeah,
of all time.
Yeah, and all because, like, of Islam. So it's like... Was it great? No, obviously not. And obviously the Nation of Islam is really problematic and they killed him.
Yeah, they murdered him.
So that's obviously a problem, but there also was that good aspect for his life too.
Yeah, it got him to where he was.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a difficult thing. It's like, he's not all good, not all bad, just like Martin Luther King is not all good or not all bad. Like, Martin Luther King was a shitty, also huge misogynist.
Yeah.
Cheated on his wife multiple times, like... Bad guy, but, like, is he a bad guy? No. Like,
no.
He did something wrong, and he's shit for that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he still is, like, the reason.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the biggest reasons that black people can vote. So,
yeah,
there you go. It's like, he's not perfect by any means, but nobody's perfect.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
It's just I think it's just the difference of how they're painted in history, too.
Definitely.
So, I think Malcolm X is painted so poorly in history, too, because... People don't want you to see his approach as, like, an approach that works.
Yeah.
Like, they want you to see, oh, sit down on the floor of the factory and everything will get better approach.
Well, you know, a girl sat down in front of the BOK Center and had a ticket to the event and got arrested. She was just, like, she was protesting and they were like, you have to move, you're trespassing. And she's like, I have a ticket. And they're like, you're trespassing.
She's like, I have a ticket.
I'm not.
I'm literally not. Anyone can have a ticket, bitch. So, I had tickets. So, yeah. So there is, we tried to look up kind of like what was real in this movie and what's not.
Yeah.
For the most part, it mostly seems incredibly authentic.
It's based on the autobiography.
Yes.
So, incredibly authentic.
It's based on the autobiography and then also, like, interviews that Spike Lee did with family members of Malcolm X. with, like, with, like, Malcolm X historians, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, it's pretty accurate. There are a few things that are different from history, but also some of those things are, like, debated.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, like, hard to tell. Like, some people don't think Malcolm X's father was murdered. Mm-hmm. Some people do. It's, like, not one of those things that we really have conclusive proof on.
But I'm just saying that if we are to believe that he had blunt force trauma to the back of the head,
yeah,
I'm gonna say he was murdered.
Murdered, yeah. So, yes. So, the best source I was actually able to find, or at least one that was the most, like, competent, is a podcast called Based on a True Story, mm-hmm. and it seems like basically they cover movies and things like that that are based on true stories, and they cover the real life aspect versus, like, the movie aspect. So you can listen to them. They link all their sources, all of those kinds of things. So I'm going to kind of go through where the movie starts getting a little different. So at the very beginning, there's a speech given by Denzel Washington as Malcolm X,
mm-hmm.
That is very similar and playing off of Martin Luther King Jr.'s very real speech, I Have a Dream. The speech was given on August 23rd, 1963, and it called for an end to racism in the U.S. by way of civil and economic rights. So it's a clever play on Dr. King's speech, even if the exact speech we hear Denzel Washington's voiceover giving isn't a real one that Malcolm X ever gave.
Okay.
But the footage that plays during that time is real. The man on his knees in the footage is Rodney King. The members standing around him beating him are members of the LAPD. Mm-hmm. And this happened on March 3rd, 1991, just before the movie was released.
Wow.
When Rodney King and two of his friends were stopped by the police for speeding. Many of the details of the incident didn't come out till later, but as a general overview, the three friends had been drinking. So when the cops tried to pull them over, Rodney, as the driver, tried to outrun the police, something Rodney King admitted to later. The chase only lasted about 8 miles before the police had Rodney's car cornered and it came to an end. Later, the officers who responded would say that they thought Rodney King was going for a gun when he moved, but Rodney King did not have any weapons. The officers ordered him to the ground at gunpoint. Four officers then approached him in anticipation of handcuffing him, but Rodney resisted. He stood up, which caused two of the officers to fall off his back. So they were on him, and they fell off when he stood up. Around here is when Rodney King was tased. If you look closely in the movie, you can see the taser wire from an officer on the left side of the footage going to Rodney. This is also roughly the point the footage began. The footage was shot by a man named George Holliday, who lived in a nearby apartment where he shot it from. After Rodney King was tasered, this is when the officers start beating him with their batons. At one point, Rodney rose to his feet and charged forward, although it's never been determined if he was charging at one of the officers or if he was trying to escape. Mm-hmm. Regardless, this opened up a new flurry of beatings. In all, Rodney King was struck 33 times with batons and received 6 kicks from police officers. It wasn't until 2 days later that George Holliday tried to get someone at the LAPD to look at the footage of the incident. No one was interested, so instead he took it to a local TV station, and that's where it blew up, causing an understandable outrage at how the police treated Rodney King. Even though the movie doesn't show it, on April 29th, 1992, the police officers on tape who beat Rodney were acquitted by a jury, and the charges were dropped. Rioting began hours later. The riots continued for the rest of April and into May. Today we know them as the 1992 Los Angeles riots that saw LAPD call for help from tens of thousands of soldiers and officials from the California National Guard, the FBI, U.S. Marshal Service, the DEA, ATF, and even 2 divisions of U.S. military brought to Los Angeles. By the time it was done, over 12,000 arrests were made, 2,000 people were injured, and 63 people died. Despite an end to the riots, as far as many people were concerned, the issue of police brutality was left unresolved, as it still is. Going back to the movie, after that introduction, we're sent back in time. The movie gives us context saying, like, we're in Boston during the war years. The camera follows Spike Lee's character. He walks over to a barbershop where we see Denzel Washington's version of Malcolm X. Although in the movie, he's not yet Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
After a brief comical bit in the barbershop, Denzel's voiceover explains Malcolm's childhood. According to the movie, a party of Klansmen surrounded their house in Omaha, Nebraska. They yelled for the father, who we hear them call Earl Little, to come out of the house. We see Malcolm's mother, who is pregnant, go out and tell the Klansmen that Earl isn't home, he's in Milwaukee. The Klansmen proceed to break all the windows in the house, terrifying Malcolm's mother and the three children we see inside. Denzel Washington's narration continues to explain that his father followed Marcus Garvey, the man who preached that black Americans couldn't find freedom, independence, and self-respect in the United States. Instead, black men should return to Africa. As for his mother, Denzel's version of Malcolm explains that she was fair-skinned because her mother was raped by a white man. She hated her complexion, and according to the movie, she married Malcolm's father in part because he was so black. While the events we see in the movie are obviously dramatized, the basic gist is true, but mm-hmm. as you can guess, there is a lot more to the story.
Mm-hmm.
The man we know today as Malcolm X was born to Earl and Louise Little on May 19, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. Only a decade early, we had seen the start of what we now refer to as the Second Klan, a reorganization of the Ku Klux Klan after it had died away post-Civil War in 1871.
Thanks, Birth of a Nation.
Thanks, Birth of a Nation. Thanks, Woodrow Wilson. The resurgence of the racist organization saw an estimated 3 to 6 million people being part of the KKK. Yes. With most historians guessing that the highest numbers peaked the year Malcolm was born, 1925.
Wow.
The movie is correct in showing that Earl Little was a preacher, a Baptist minister, actually. Reverend Earl was, like the movie shows, harassed by local KKK members. A big part of this was because Earl was very outspoken for black rights.
Mm-hmm.
The other name the movie mentions, Marcus Garvey, was a real person. He founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League in 1914. 2 years later, Marcus moved to the United States, Harlem in New York, and his beliefs started to gain a following. The basic idea for the organization was that racial pride and economic self-sufficiency. Marcus believed, like the movie suggested, that neither one of those things could ever happen in the United States, so he suggested that black men and women move to Africa to start an independent nation. The movie doesn't mention this, but even though a lot of people believed Marcus Garvey's vision, they didn't like that he wanted to be president of that new nation himself. For this reason, Marcus and the NAACP had an ongoing feud soon after his arrival in the U.S. However, Earl and Louise Little were among the people who believed in Marcus's vision. In fact, Earl was the local leader of Marcus's UNIA organization.
Mm.
So that's probably why the members of the KKK painted a target on their family.
Yeah.
And just like the movie shows, while Reverend Little was preaching in Milwaukee, a group of KKK men on horseback showed up at their home. Louise was pregnant with Malcolm, and when she stood up to the men so that they could see she was pregnant, they responded pretty much in the same way they do in the movie, by breaking their windows with their rifles. What the movie doesn't show us was that after Earl returned home, he was furious. Malcolm would later recall that his father was not afraid of the KKK, but he's not sure why they moved. So he's not sure why they moved, but they did. They decided to wait until Louise had the baby, though. As we learned, Malcolm X was born on May 19th. In early 1926, the Little family moved to Milwaukee. There, soon after, they moved to Lansing, Michigan. This is where most of Malcolm's childhood was spent, although moving further north did not stop the racist threats. In 1929, the Little's home was burned down. Officially, there has never been an explanation as to who is behind it, but Earl is pretty sure it was the Black Legions, another racist white supremacist group a lot like the KKK,
mm-hmm.
who had been harassing the family ever since they moved to Lansing. And then things get worse. As the official story differs from what most close to the incident believe. This time, the official records reflect that Earl Little died in an accident. Other stories surrounding the incident said that Earl was beaten and forced to lie down on the streetcar track until he was run over by the car.
If their past troubles of the KKK and the Black Legions threatening their lives, I would probably say that he was murdered.
Yeah. Not to get too far ahead of where we are in the movie's timeline, but we see flashbacks of this later on in the film. Earl's body was cut nearly in half, his head was smashed in, and Earl Little died in 1931 when Malcolm was only 6. So I think a lot of the reason that there is no, like, official record is, for one, the police probably didn't do a very thorough autopsy on him.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, he was hit by a streetcar.
Yeah, like...
So they could have been like, oh, he fell and he got drunk, whatever, you know what I mean? Yeah, he's gonna be pretty beat up.
Mm-hmm.
As you can imagine, all of this had an incredible impact on Malcolm while he was growing up. He stayed in Michigan until, while in junior high, he moved in with his half-sister in Boston.
Mm.
Skipping ahead a bit. Shorty, real person.
Oh, nice.
Everyone just called him Shorty. They could not figure out what his real name was. No one's ever figured it out. But he befriended Malcolm in Boston because Shorty was also from Michigan, Lansing, Michigan.
Very cool.
So the next thing that happens, Malcolm's girlfriend, Laura.
Laura, that's her name.
Malcolm notices Sophia. Later, Malcolm walks Laura home. She's pretty cold. As he's saying goodnight, she suggests that he's going to see Sophia. He denies it. Though Laura says, what's the point? I'm not white. I don't put out. The basic plot here is true, although the real woman's name was not Sophia. The name Malcolm X gave in his autobiography was a fake name as well. Mm-hmm. So we don't know her real name. But as the story goes, he did hook up with her. That did happen while he did cheat on Laura.
Yeah.
He said he was not proud of this, as he explained in his autobiography, to be a black man dating a white woman was sort of a status symbol. So yeah, they do all this stuff. He does meet this guy named West Indian Archie. That does happen. They do become impressed. He does start working for him. All of that's true. The fact that he says that the number, he has that number, that's true.
Yeah.
But it's not completely how it happened. So while Malcolm was working for the railroad, he liked to go to some poker games that would take place at Grand Central Station. One time, the cops busted the game while Malcolm was there. No one was arrested, but the running with the cops at the station was enough for Malcolm to lose his job at the railroad. And even though Malcolm was arrested with a pistol, the cops couldn't find it because he had it on the small of his back. The cops didn't think to look there. In the movie, Archie is the one who tells Malcolm to do this, but in truth, Malcolm did this of his own accord.
That's like a tiny little detail.
Yeah. After this, Malcolm did what he could to make a living on the streets of Harlem. Primarily, this meant robberies and a string of drug use that helped him stay cool during those robberies. After this is when Malcolm met up with Archie. So, thief first, then he meets up with Archie.
Okay.
The movie is correct in showing that Archie ran a numbers game and Malcolm started running those numbers. What the movie doesn't do is explain what the number game is. So, it's basically a lottery. It's illegal, as you can guess, but that didn't mean it wasn't extremely popular, especially with working-class Americans.
Okay.
The basic idea was every day there was a new number. You placed a bet on what that number would be, very much like the actual lottery, and then there'd be three levels involved. The banker, who held the bets, and the tally of who had what bets. The runner, which was the middleman between you and the banker, who told the banker what your bet was. And then there's you, the person betting by giving the runner what number you think will win.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when the day's number is picked, if you pick the right number, the runner would give you your winnings from the banker. How did they determine a day's number? Well, that varied depending on the city you were in. One of the common ways was to pick the last digits in a series of numbers. Let's say the New York Stock Exchange traded 13,151 stocks in one day. Well, then the winning number would be 151. So, maybe it'd be numbers from different sources. Say, the last number of the NYSE trades, the first number of the market cap at closing. These are just random examples. So, if there's 13,151 stocks traded, the last number is 1. If the market cap is, say, 959,213, the first number would be 9. And then if Ford stock closed at 521, the number would be 2. So, 192 is that day's number. Of course, just an example. Sometimes it would be numbers from New York Stock Exchange. Basically, they just pick up these numbers. That's what Malcolm got involved doing in his days of Harlem gambling and robbing.
Okay.
But he didn't run into Archie because of an altercation in a bar like we see in the movie. Instead, Malcolm had a different runner he'd given his number to, but then after a bad streak, he decided to change his runner. Then he found Archie, who was known for being a great runner due to his photographic memory. Just like the movie doesn't give any sort of indication of timing, but it was around 1945 when Malcolm's relationship with Archie went sour, and it was, like the movie shows, because of a bet. But it didn't go down like the movie shows. Even though Malcolm placed his own bets with Archie, he'd also started working with him as a runner. Sometimes Malcolm's own bets would hit, sometimes they didn't. One day, Malcolm collected on a bet he'd made, $300 for a 50-cent bet. Not bad. In 1945, $300 would be like $4,200.
Okay.
So, as he always did, Archie paid Malcolm without any question. That evening, Malcolm went to a bar with a pretty girl on his arm and money burned a hole in his pocket. The next day, Malcolm was awoken by an angry Archie banging on his door. It seemed that after giving Malcolm the money, Archie had gone back to the banker as he always did. That was the only time Archie ever wrote down the numbers when he gave them to the banker. At that point, Archie was certain Malcolm had bet on a different number. That means Malcolm didn't win after all. But Archie had paid him $300 out of his own pocket, trusting Malcolm.
Okay.
So, have you ever been so sure of something at the time, but as soon as someone casts doubts on you, you start to doubt it yourself? Well, that's what happened here. In the movie, the number is 821, but there's nothing I can find to let you know whether or not that's true.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, it's probably right in the middle, where both sides were so sure right up until the other party cast doubt on them. But the number of the day and the number of Malcolm's bet are neither really here nor there. The result was pretty much the same. Malcolm said he bet a number that won. Archie said Malcolm bet a different number. So when Archie barged into Malcolm's room the next day and wanted the 300 back, except Malcolm had been spending all the money before, so he didn't have it. Archie left in a rage, telling Malcolm he had until noon the next day. It wasn't really about the money. Even though Malcolm hadn't spent all of the money that night, their relationship was one that saw thousands of dollars in exchanging hands. It was a matter of trust. Malcolm had a choice. He could either face Archie or he could run. The next day when Archie found Malcolm again trying to get the rest of his money, it was a showdown at gunpoint. Malcolm nearly tried to reach for his own gun until Archie caught him off guard, until Archie called him on it. Archie knew Malcolm was going to try to do so, so he reminded Malcolm that he was young. Archie, on the other hand, was 60 years old, and he'd spent time in Sing Sing, one of the oldest prisons in the U.S. Archie's point was clear. If Malcolm killed Archie, he'd ruin his own life more than he'd ruin Archie's. And as you can probably guess, neither Archie nor Malcolm pulled a trigger that day.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no, like, gun showdown as there was in the movie. But that trust had been lost and was never regained, so the working relationship was over.
Mm-hmm.
So, yup. Then it all kind of is the same, where they really do get sentenced and all that stuff. That did really happen.
Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting. There's a cameo in the movie. The racist judge is played by a man named William Kunstler. If you're not familiar with who he was, Kunstler was made a name for himself as a lawyer working civil rights cases in the 50s and 60s, as he defended countless men and women who had been subjected to prejudice by the American judicial system.
Interesting.
So, basically exactly what we see happening in the movie here. Kunstler never served as a lawyer for the real Malcolm X, though he did make a mark on civil rights in the United States and even served as the director of the ACLU between 1964 and 1977.
Oh.
But all of that was true, as far as, like, the... Sorry, I accidentally clicked off the page. As far as them getting arrested and getting that sentence and those girls getting that sentence,
mm-hmm.
Yes, that really happened. Again, sorry, I lost my place. Trying to find it.
It's a movie.
Long movie. Such a long movie. Boop, 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 boop. Yeah, that really did happen, though. So, there you go. There apparently were two other accomplices, but they were not arrested at the same time or the same place. But one of the accomplices was never charged. The cops never knew about him, while the other one managed to get away.
Interesting.
So, not everyone was arrested that was actually a part of it. And just like the movie shows, Malcolm did serve, an 8 to 10 year prison sentence. As for the women, they did get less time. There was a lot more racism throughout the experience that the movie does not show.
I'm sure.
Everyone from the county court clerks to bailiffs to court-appointed lawyers seemed to hone in on the white women arrested with black men thing. The fact that they were all charged with the same crimes does not matter very much. The women each got 1 to 5 years at the Women's Reformatory in Framingham, Massachusetts, while Malcolm and Shorty got 8 to 10 years at Charleston State Prison.
Wild.
Yeah. So.
Disappointed, but not surprised.
Disappointed, but not surprised. So, in the movie, they obviously speed this up a little bit, how when he hears about Muhammad.
Uh-huh.
That actually didn't happen for a couple of years, until a couple of years after he was sent to prison. By this time, he'd been transferred to the colored prison, where he got a letter from one of his friends. In the letter, his friend named Filbert told Malcolm he'd joined the Nation of Islam. Then later, another letter arrived for Malcolm. This time it was from Reginald, who was one of Malcolm's closest friends during his Harlem days. Reginald said he knew of a way for Malcolm to get out of prison and told him to stop smoking cigarettes and stop eating pork. Malcolm didn't really know what he meant, but was determined to do whatever he had to do to get out, so he stopped smoking and he stopped eating pork. All this time, Malcolm's sister Ella had been petitioning the courts to get her brother transferred to a better prison, Norfolk Prison Colony. He eventually was transferred there at the end of 1948. One major benefit of this was that Colony's visitation rules were way more lenient than any other prison he'd been at.
Mm.
They allowed Reginald to come and visit Malcolm and finally answered the question Malcolm had wondered. How will not eating pork and smoking help me get out of prison? Reginald explained that God is a man that has 360 degrees of knowledge. He knows everything. God's real name is Allah, and he had revealed himself to Elijah Muhammad, a black man. Then Reginald continued to explain that on the other end of the spectrum, the devil only has 33 degrees of knowledge. He told Malcolm that white man is the devil, and worst of all, are where the 33 degrees come from, the Masons.
I don't like the Masons either.
After Reginald left, Malcolm was left with plenty of time to do nothing but think. He'd certainly had a hard time with racism in his life, but he'd known some good white men too. Oh, there's a brief moment in the movie where Denzel Washington's version of Malcolm confronts the prison's priest. Malcolm asks what color Jesus and the disciples were. The priest says, "We don't know for certain." Malcolm says, "Jesus wasn't white," to which the priest shoots, "Black, God is white, can't you see?" He points to a painting behind him of blonde-haired boy Jesus. Malcolm says, "Yes, I can see in the painting he's white, but Jesus was a Hebrew." And that Elijah Muhammad teaches us that the paintings and depictions we see throughout churches are not historically correct.
That's true.
That confrontation did happen, although the priest never said God was white. And he wasn't really a priest. He was a seminary student. So, that's not really the kind of question he expected, but the student admitted that, yes, Paul was Hebrew, and all original Hebrews were black. So Paul was probably black. But that's when the question of Jesus's color came up. The entire class was enthralled. No one had ever thought to question the countless paintings that showed Jesus to be white. After a pause, the student said that Jesus was brown. It was a compromise, and Malcolm stopped pushing it after that.
Wow.
So, that was not so true. But yeah, it seems like it wasn't like a prison friend that taught him about it. It was a real friend he had outside of prison.
Gotcha.
So, Malcolm did have trouble bending his knees in prayer. It wasn't Baines who told Malcolm to pray like how we see in the movie. Instead, it was after writing a letter to Muhammad. It was the reply that encouraged Malcolm to bend his knees and pray. Not only that, but letters from his family helped. So it seemed like a lot of it was through letters. He corresponded through letters.
Uh-huh.
So there's another important bit the movie doesn't mention. Well, sort of. By that, I'm referring to when we see the movie briefly mention that Malcolm wrote letters to a bunch of his old friends, the hustlers and people he ran with. The reason this is important is because it was around this time that Malcolm had finally bent his knee in prayer to Allah, and he started writing letters to anyone he could think of. He started telling them about the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, and as the movie briefly mentions, he even wrote the President of the United States, Harry S. Truman. Of course, Truman never responded.
Naturally.
But it was at this time that the FBI opened up a file on Malcolm Little because of the letter.
Oh, J. Edgar Hoover.
And that brings us to a bit of importance. Little. It was around this time that Malcolm Little became Malcolm X. As he later explained, the name Little had been given to his ancestors by slave masters. He was renouncing the name.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, the character Baines tells Malcolm he needs to learn all the words in the dictionary to uncover their true meaning. That did not really happen. What happened was that Malcolm started writing so many letters, he started getting frustrated with his lack of knowledge. He couldn't express the thoughts in his head on paper. He turned to the well-read Bimby, who suggested Malcolm start studying the dictionary. So he did. Then he was actually paroled after 6 years. So, basically, you know when he visits Archie in the movie? That did mm-hmm. happen.
Okay.
But there was nothing to suggest that Archie ever had a stroke, like in the movie it showed. He was elderly, of course, because mm-hmm. this would have been like 15 years after he was 60, so he was like 75. And he was sick. But he also greeted Malcolm at the door when he knocked, and after a while he remembered who he was and they had a chat.
Okay.
Apparently, they did actually talk about the numbers thing that ruined their relationship, and they both decided to put it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, pretty much all of that is real. Malcolm really did propose to his wife over the phone, and 2 days later, they were married.
Mm-hmm.
So, the movie doesn't really give us a time span of their relationship, but they actually met 3 years before they were married.
Okay.
So, the timeline is a bit off. They did get married very quickly. They were engaged very quickly, obviously, but they actually knew each other for a
gotcha.
While.
They sped it up a little bit.
Yes, before they did in real life. But there are some contradicting stories of when he... Oh, there are also some contradicting stories about when he was actually appointed national minister.
Okay.
It's either 1961 or 1962. No one really knows, I guess.
That's fine.
Yeah. So... Sorry, I'm trying to, like, kind of get through this quickly. So, all about the rumors of Elijah Muhammad's inappropriate behavior, they don't tell us in the movie, but this would have been 3 years after Malcolm got out of prison that he would have been doing this inappropriate behavior.
Okay.
So for a really long time, he refused to believe it. Yeah. Everyone refused to believe it. They sped it up in the movie, his coming to terms with it,
uh-huh.
obviously to make it shorter. but basically, the women who ended up pregnant with Muhammad's baby would often, like, be tried and charged with adultery and sent off to isolation, basically exiled from contact with any other Muslims.
Oh, wow.
So the nation was covering it all up. We don't really know if this was on purpose or if, like Malcolm X, many of the nation simply couldn't fathom that Elijah Muhammad was guilty of adultery and they thought they were lying.
Yeah.
So, in this movie, so like the movie shows, Malcolm did investigate on his own. He did break protocol and look up the women who were still in their isolated state. These women claimed to have Muhammad's children. He found not only were these not just stories, but that Elijah Muhammad had been bad-mouthing Malcolm X behind his back. He'd been telling women Malcolm was dangerous and not someone to be trusted. Finally, Malcolm did talk to Elijah Muhammad. He confronted the leader, and Elijah Muhammad did not deny any of it. Instead, he referenced men in the Bible who had done similar things. For example, King of David stealing Uriah's wife, Bathsheba.
Mm-hmm.
While this was happening, something else did happen that we see in the movie. President Kennedy was, in fact, assassinated. If you did not know, Malcolm X did use that same chickens coming home to roost metaphor mm-hmm. in real life. That was all very real. It was very controversial. Even though Malcolm claimed his words were misinterpreted and he had simply meant that hatred had spread so much to create a society in which the assassination could be possible, Elijah Muhammad did suspend him for 90 days. And after already being upset with everything we learned about Muhammad's adultery and believing that coming home to roost bit had only been an excuse for suspension, Malcolm X publicly announced he was leaving the Nation of Islam, just like in the movie.
Okay.
So, he also really did do Mecca. It really was eye-opening. All of that was really true. Also, at this time, Malcolm X gave himself a surname, although it's often not mentioned, Shabazz.
Yep.
So... that was actually became his surname before he died.
Okay.
So he was no longer Malcolm X, he was Malcolm Shabazz. And he really did say that he was willing to work with writers, and he said that thing about when Malcolm X plane comes and they ask him what happened. His reply was real, that he said white people are allowed to have guns, it's constitutional for self-defense, but when black people have them, it's ominous. Then Malcolm went on to explain that even though he made sweeping statements about all white people before, he would never do that again. His trip to Mecca showed him that all races can live together in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
But he also pointed out that racism was still a problem.
For
sure. All of that was very accurate. A lot of the speeches he gave were incredibly accurate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And just, like, his house was really bombed. That really did happen.
And he really did die how he died.
Yep, and he really did die how he died. And all of that is true. So that's pretty much where it ends.
Yeah, so pretty much everything important.
Pretty much everything is real.
Yep.
He corresponded through letters instead of actually meeting someone in prison.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably just to make it more interesting, to give it a character.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So.
What would you give this movie?
Oh, 10 out of 10.
Me too.
Maybe 9 out of 10 because it's really long.
It's really long, but it gives you like the full picture.
Very much. It's
Spike Lee is wonderful. They do this great double dolly shot at the end as he does. Amazing.
It's incredibly accurate too.
Yeah.
Which is another thing. Like they just how incredibly accurate it is.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a terrible review. As per always, they were pretty much all terrible.
I hate IMDb reviews.
I know. People are so stupid. Here we go. 1 out of 10. horribly racist movie.
No! Why do they keep calling it racist?
I don't know. It actually caused mild nausea. Bless your soul.
Oh, that must be so hard for you.
This movie was disgraceful. The idea that black people hold Malcolm X up as an idol is reprehensible. Malcolm X was the very thing he hated in whites. Angry and racist. People that idolize Malcolm X should really research history. If black rights were left in the hands of Malcolm X and those like him, black people would probably still have no rights to this day. If you think that what they did to the Japanese during World War II was bad, had X gotten his way and started a race war, African Americans would have suffered immensely more and probably floridly immigrated to other countries. Well, he wanted them just to immigrate. That
is, yeah.
He vehemently tried to start a race war that had zero chance of winning because they had zero political power. It pains me to think of what good African Americans would have went through if people like Malcolm X been the only leader for coloreds.
Oh, no!
Black people should thank God for men like MLK, who knew how to actually affect real change in the hearts and minds of society.
Wow, he really did that. Because everything has changed.
I know. Hostility would have created severe tribalism among races and been met with an extreme amount of violence and political pressure. Because that's not already how it is.
Yeah, that's not already happening at all.
The fact that this movie holds up X as some kind of hero is nauseating. He was an extreme anti-white racist. He was an ignorant man, the exact black version of a neo-Nazi skinhead. This movie sickens me. He was not a hero, and I hope people realize that. Ignorance breeds ignorance. I don't understand how this has a 7.7 rating. The Nation of Islam is a known cult. Malcolm X was a hardcore racist bigot. He did nothing except anger and scare people. He almost made civil rights not happen and had a war in its place. This movie is trash garbage.
Okay, first of all, there's this book called Me and White Supremacy. And in that book, it says that racism is actually the combination of power and prejudice. So, black people actually can't be racist to white people because they don't have power.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you can be prejudiced against white people,
Your prejudice is because of what white people did to you and not because of their skin color.
Also, not only that, but your prejudice means nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you can be prejudiced against someone, but at the end of the day, if your prejudice doesn't have literally any effect on anything, then mm-hmm. it doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not great, but it's like, you shouldn't be, but also, it doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
And also, again, we just read an incredibly long, like, 30-minute review that basically said that everything in this movie is 100% real.
Yes.
Like, nearly every single
thing. So, your idea of them painting like Malcolm X as a hero, this is all real. Accurate.
I know, it's like, it's just real. It's like, that's just really what happened. So, you can be like, oh, well then maybe he wasn't, maybe, like, the truth is, he's not as bad as you thought.
Yeah.
Maybe the truth is that the history book that you've read paints him as a villain, rather than him being painted as a hero in this thing. He's being painted as a villain in history.
And I don't even think he's, like, painted as exactly, like, a hero. No, I think that, like, obviously, like, he did amazing things, and it's really important to learn about him, but I don't think, the movie's pretty, like, this is just what happened.
I know, and also, he doesn't try to start a race
war. No, he never, all he wanted was white people to leave him alone.
Yeah, he never was like, let's kill white people. He was just like, let's not deal with white people ever. He's at the worst, most, like, prejudiced part of his life that he was in, basically all he said was, we shouldn't associate with white people anymore.
Yeah, that's all he said.
That's literally it.
And white people, like, did that, like, way before he did that.
Literally, I love it. This is, like, my favorite thing ever, which is, during this time, white people are mad at Malcolm X for wanting to segregate, even though they
want to segregate.
Even though they're segregating the races. White people are like, yes, we are segregating the races. And then Malcolm X is like, yeah, we should segregate the races.
They're like, wait, no.
Well, I don't want you to want it. It's supposed to punish you. Literally. And here's what it is. Here's why I think it gets painted so badly. Because racist white people were kind of okay with Malcolm X. I mean, they didn't love that. They thought Malcolm X was, like, racist to them, and they didn't like him. But his idea of, like, all the black people leave all the white people, they were like, hell yeah, that's exactly what we've been asking for.
Mm-hmm.
But the good white people, right, like, Quotes, good. The white people that were, like, on MLK side who wanted to, like, fix things for black people, which, like, no, not bad. Good for them. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously on the right side of history there. But also, they were really against Malcolm X because to them, it's kind of like when you don't consider yourself racist and someone's like, you're being racist. And then you're like, well, no, I'm not. What's wrong with you? You hate white people. And it's like, just this like knee-jerk reaction where you're like, well, I'm doing a good thing, so I should not be punished. But it's like, well, you doing a good thing doesn't like somehow absolve you of every bad thing that other people of your race have done.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, just because, like, you were a Nazi that didn't kill a Jew doesn't mean that, like, you weren't still a Nazi.
Exactly.
So, like, I don't know. It's like, you can't be like, well, I was actually for the Jews. And it's like, well, what did you do?
What did you do?
Nothing.
Did you hide a Jew in your house? No.
So shut up. So it's like, yeah, it's like one of those things where it's like this knee-jerk reaction that you're like, well, that's bad because I was for them and we're the good white people and those are the bad white people. And it's like, well, it's not really all that simple. And the fact that you are mad at him for wanting what he wants, in a way, kind of like, it doesn't make you a bad white person, but it doesn't make you a great white person
either. No, you're not being understanding. You're not at all. You need to, like, have a little compassion.
And then that's the thing is, like, the people that wrote that history book then about segregation, obviously you're going to try and paint white people in the best possible light. And Malcolm X didn't really do that. So you have to understand, like, that's probably, like, a big part of the reason that he looks so bad in history. And, like, Malcolm X, again, in his late life, said, like, that he was fine with white people.
Yeah.
That he wanted...
That he learned that, like...
That he wanted a mixed-race society. Like, he wanted that. But also, again, his life was cut short. So it's like...
What? He could have done so much more.
Exactly. You don't know. It's like... We kind of have to take him at his word at the end of his life, I guess, that he was okay with it. I mean, he was literally killed for standing up to the institution that you're mad that he supported.
Yes, that's why he died.
He literally died because he publicly came out and left the very thing that you guys are mad that he was a part of.
Yeah.
It's like, well, he died for it, so I guess he paid his penance. If you're, like, upset that he did that, it's like, well, he paid the ultimate price to, you know...
Speak what he believed in.
To retract those statements.
Yeah.
So it's like you can't really be mad at him.
No.
For that. And I think it's really interesting that this movie, I think that's probably why Spike Lee did stick so close to history. Not only because it's interesting enough as it is.
Definitely.
But also because if he had made up a bunch of dramatic bullshit that made Malcolm X look like this god.
Yeah.
Then
people would have been like,
well, that's not true. Here's this and this and this. But the fact is, this is
like, everything is accurate.
This is all accurate. And the fact that you're saying, oh, well, look at history. It's like, well, what history are you looking at?
Because this is what happened.
Yeah. I mean, this is what happened. And you can read on the Based on the True Story podcast. They link all their sources. They're all lots and lots of sources.
Yeah.
Lots of different types of sources. It's a very accurate depiction of history. Again, Spike Lee didn't just go off the autobiography.
He interviewed people. I'm sure he read other
books. He talked to historians who specifically, work on Malcolm X. And again, like, and this is, I think this is a great picture of just who Malcolm was as a person.
Definitely.
Which is, like, not a perfect person. But not a villain. Not this, like, black terrorist that we learn about.
Exactly, either. Exactly.
So it's, like, just like Selma. Like, MLK wasn't perfect. Like, you have to understand that, like, painting... These people were not perfect people.
Yeah.
And they did something good, and they did something noteworthy, and they did something that should be remembered.
And that changed the world.
And it changed the world, but they're not perfect. I mean, like, Gandhi literally got India liberated from British colonizers. That's obviously an amazing thing. But Gandhi was also a horrible racist who believed in India's caste system, who believed that black people should be lower in that caste system than they already were.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you can't make a movie about Gandhi and not talk about that. Because that's bad. Like, that is something that he did that was bad, and that was a part of him. And it doesn't mean that him liberating India from colonization wasn't good, but it also, like, people paint Gandhi as, like, this peaceful god who never did anything wrong in his life, and it's like, well, that's just not accurate.
That's just not true.
It doesn't mean is...
It doesn't make his work any more, any less valuable.
Exactly. Exactly. And Malcolm X, too, like...
The fact that he was a little misogynistic.
Yeah, and it's like Malcolm X painting him... And not only this, but, like, portraying Malcolm X as a complete villain totally underwrites all the good that he did for the civil rights movement.
Yes.
And completely underwrites how good of a speaker he was and how powerful of a black man he was during that time. And you have to understand that, like, you got to take the good with the bad and understand that it doesn't make it any... Like, George Washington founded the country. I'm good on George Washington. Thank you. But also...
He had slaves.
But also, he ripped... His dentures were made from slave teeth, okay? Like... Doesn't mean he didn't do something good,
yeah.
But it also, he wasn't perfect. And part of that is, like, product of their time. Yes, obviously, mm-hmm. It was acceptable then for him to do what he did. It was acceptable for Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X to be horrible, rampant misogynists. Yes. It was acceptable for Gandhi to be racist. All of those things were 100% acceptable, but they're not acceptable in today's culture. And
exactly.
It, in my opinion... It's not like taking away history to acknowledge that they all did bad things and that they all did good things. It's making a more complete, full history that people can then, like, make decisions on.
Definitely.
Because it's, I mean, it's a hard thing to come, I think it's hard to come to terms with because when you're, like, you grow up, like, we learn, like, Martin Luther King Jr. is, like, this angel saint who's never done anything wrong and he mm-hmm. friggin' single-handedly stopped racism, right? Like... We're like, whoa, Martin also, Luther King Jr.
He cheated on his wife
but
a lot.
But then when somebody comes out and they're like, hey, Martin Luther King, kind of a piece of shit. And you're like, well, how dare you? That man did this and this. And it's like, it's this is like knee-jerk reaction that you learn. It's like when you learn that like your favorite celebrity of all time is like a dick.
Yeah.
It sucks. Because you're like, you have this weird idea and you've been like, I don't want to say, like, indoctrinated, but, like, yeah. Yes. With this idea of, like, what they're like in person or what they were like. And then when you find out that they're not like that, it's, like, a knee-jerk reaction to want to be, like, well, you're lying.
You're wrong.
Or you're trying to discredit all the good they've done. Or you're trying to discredit their talent. And it's, like, well, no. But you... But how does it hurt to have a more complete picture?
You do need to have more information to make proper decisions.
Exactly. And it helps you have a more complete, like, view. It doesn't mean, like... That you've never done anything good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I don't know. It's like, you, it helps to have a more complete picture. And you can, and like, people tearing down Gandhi statues and stuff, it's like, well, yeah, that's a, I mean, it's a more complete picture of history. And if people decide they don't want to, like, stand Gandhi anymore, then, like, okay.
Yeah.
Or, like, John Lennon, great freaking example. John Lennon, like, a super, super talented man mm-hmm. who did a lot of good in the world, who was also an abusive asshole. Yeah. He abused people, and he... weirdly idolized the idea of being assassinated. Like,
yeah, he really wanted to be assassinated. He, like, would mention it all the time.
Like, it's not... It doesn't mean that, like, John Lennon... His accomplishments are, like, any less. That, like, he wasn't a part of, like, the group that made pop music. And that he wasn't, like... Didn't, like... Help with the Vietnam War effort. Mm-hmm. Like, one of... Single-handedly, like, was one of the greatest celebrity voices on... being anti-Vietnam. Right. Of course he was, and of course he did all those things, but also to say, like, to just not acknowledge that he was abusive does kind of erase Yoko's experience as his wife.
Definitely.
And that's not fair. Like, I'm gonna use Michael Jackson here. Like, we know how we feel.
We know how we feel about
Michael
that.
Michael Jackson, more than likely, like, pretty substantial proof that he abused little boys and was sexually molesting little boys for years.
Wait. Okay, we just sleep in the same bed together. We're just best friends. It's nothing sexual, it's like, I promise.
Yeah, babe. Okay, like, even if we didn't have all the boys coming out and being like, it was sexual, even if that's all we had, it would still be sketchy as fuck. Listen,
he admitted that he slept in the same bed as the little boys.
Also, tons of people saw it.
Tons of people who, like, worked with him and stuff knew that he, like, slept in the same bed as
okay,
little boys.
Okay, we all knew he was a pedophile and we also let it go. And why did that happen? Because people were like, well, he's the king of pop. Like, yeah. He... single-handedly changed the game. And, like, did he?
Yes!
But did that...
Did he also rape little boys?
Yes! And, like, you can still think, like, oh, Michael Jackson was talented and he did a lot for the music industry without having to be like, but therefore he has no faults. It's like, no, he did. He was a pedophile. And that's a big fault.
Yes.
And that's, like, not a product of his time. That's, like, he's a piece of shit who yes. abused little boys. And... refusing to acknowledge that, like, me acknowledging that does not say, like, and therefore all Michael Jackson music is shit and is has bad. Always been shit. It's like, no.
I've never enjoyed a Michael Jackson
song. That man has some catchy fucking songs. I can't deny it. But, again, I'm not going out of my way to... I'm not gonna pretend like I'm just he's not an abuser, because all that that does is pave the way for future abusers to be like, well, as long as I'm doing something important creatively, I can do it. I'm gonna get a free pass.
Yeah.
And the fact is that, like, if you love Michael Jackson and you didn't know that he was an abuser and then you found out, it's gonna feel bad.
It sucks.
It's gonna feel bad because you're like, well, I love his music, and now you're never gonna be able to listen to him and not think about the fact that he raped little boys.
And I can't either.
And it's like, that's like a more complete picture of who Michael Jackson is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make his accomplishments any less valid. It doesn't mean that his songs aren't good or that you can't think that they're good. But you do need to acknowledge that what he did was fucked up, and had we known that in life, had we, the public, known that in life, that you would have needed to support him being jailed.
Yeah.
For that. And it's like, yeah, that's bad. It's bad. Does it mean that what he did is less important? No. But to just refuse to acknowledge that any of these, like, heroed figures that we have in American culture are not perfect people, or that they have sometimes very serious, serious flaws.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not, you wouldn't do that for, like, your neighbor.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what, I can't remember what comedian made a joke about it, but was like, if Michael Jackson, like, took your kid and would sleep in the same bed with him, you're like, it's fine. But what if that was, like, your trash guy?
I've been saying that forever. Like, how would you feel, like, if you wouldn't let your next door neighbor do it, if your next door neighbor was like, I'm just best friends with your 6-year-old son, and we just have sleepovers all the time, and we tell secrets, and, you know, we're BFFs, like, would you not be uncomfortable? Would you let that happen?
No, you wouldn't.
Some people would.
That's true. Some people would.
Some people totally let that happen. But clearly, people let it happen because he was famous, because he gave them lots of money,
yep.
And I guess $10,000 is what the price of your child is worth to some of these people.
Mm-hmm. And fame.
And fame. All of that is worth it to you, I guess. And it's messed up, and a lot of them hid it for many, many years, even years after his death, because he was such an icon. And to be honest, all that does is speak to how powerful the hero status we give to people is.
Definitely.
And how hard it is for people to come out and say, like, well, he may have done this, but he also did this.
Yeah.
And it's hard, and I think that's something that society is still kind of, like, coming to terms with, which is this idea of, like, how do I appreciate art that an artist has made, or how do I appreciate the accomplishments someone has done with when they're a terrible person? How do I, like, come to terms with that? And it's, like, I think it's kind of the same way you come to terms with someone who's a massive dick.
Yeah.
Who's a good singer. Like, Never Shout Never was, like, my favorite band when I was a child.
Yeah.
I literally loved them. And I've met Christopher Drew, and he is a huge asshole. He's a terrible person. Does that mean he's not a good singer? Not really. Like, I still like his music. I still jam to his music. But I don't really go out of my way to defend him.
Definitely.
I'm not going... In fact, when people are, like, going out of their way to defend him, I'm like, by the way, I know this guy, and he's not a nice guy. Like, him being talented is nothing to do with his personality.
Definitely.
And also, I think a big part of it is, especially if they're using their power to abuse.
Definitely.
I think giving them, especially when they're alive, giving them money is something that you should really take a look at yourself and consider.
What you're doing.
What you're doing. Like,
are you promoting this behavior?
Are you promoting this behavior? Exactly. Like, it's kind of like now Michael Jackson's dead. Michael Jackson is not receiving any money for any of the songs that he... That if you listen to his song on a streaming service, Michael Jackson's not getting cash for that.
Yeah.
So if you want to listen to his song, it's like, and you know, and as long as you kind of recognize that this man was not a good person and you're not defending him, I don't really see any problem with you, like, listening to Thriller.
It's like, I love watching Rosemary's Baby, but I would never buy it.
No, exactly. It's like, Roman Polanski is a piece of shit. Does that mean he didn't make great movies? No, he's a great director. But I'm also not going to go out and buy anything that gives Roman Polanski money.
Definitely.
So, like, when Roman Polanski... If you already own Rosemary's Baby, it's like, watch it. You already have the money. Like,
yeah.
Whatever. But if you're going to, like, if you're like, Roman Polanski just released a new film, am I going to go see it?
No.
No.
I'm going to wait till it comes out on a streaming service
and
or something.
And then maybe I'll watch it. Or maybe someone else owns it, maybe I'll watch it. This is a really great example. Sorry, this episode's getting really long, but whatever. We didn't release one last week, so. Something really interesting I find is, like, Kevin Spacey, I think, is an amazing example of this.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin Spacey comes out. He's, like, a pedophile.
Yeah.
And he's a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
People are upset. So what happens? Kevin Spacey obviously loses a lot of his jobs, but there was a movie, okay, that came out recently after the thing came out.
Yeah, it came out right after.
It was clearly filmed before anyone knew, or at least before we knew.
Yeah.
But it comes out, that movie tanked, did so fucking bad, and you know what that means? It means Kevin Spacey is never going to be cast in another film. Because when you don't spend your money, what it says to Hollywood, what it says to these producers is, the star power is not greater than the actions that the star takes.
This is unacceptable, and we need to send the message that it is unacceptable.
Yes. It's like, if you go see the Kevin Spacey film, even though you know he's a piece of shit, you can go in there and be like, okay, well, I know Kevin Spacey's a piece of shit, but I still like his acting. And it's like, yeah, American Beauty's a good movie. I just can't help it. It's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
Kevin Spacey's a good actor. But he's still alive, and he's using his power to prey on people. So am I going to go see anything new? Am I going to continue to give him my money?
No.
Like, because giving him money is what allows him to mess up. And if the studios see that we, as the consumer, don't care that he's a pedophile, they'll continue to cast him.
Yeah, exactly. We need to send the message that we're not okay with it.
Exactly. And it's like, it's a delicate balance because you want to support good art, and it does hurt other people in other films. Like, but at the end of the day, if you choose to do a film with Kevin Spacey, then you are just as much part of the problem. Like, you should not, no person with any influence should be agreeing to work with people that are bad people. Like, that are known abusers and stuff.
Definitely. Because they are sending the message that it's okay.
Exactly. And it's like, that is just something you have to consider, and it's like, one day Kevin Spacey will die, and then you can watch that movie, because he's not going to get anything from it. If you're really interested, you can watch the movie. My guess is, your life is going to be just as good. Like, Rosemary's Baby, you can watch it without paying Roman Polanski a dime, okay?
Yes.
So go watch it. Like, you can do all this stuff without paying these artists. But you have to understand, the money helps them do what they do.
Yes.
So you have to be kind of discerning. And luckily we're kind of entering an era where a lot of streaming services are making that decision for people.
Yeah.
They're saying, we're not going to put up these stand-up shows, we're not going to do all this stuff for known abusers.
At Louis C.K.
But you still have to be, like, discerning. And again, like Louis C.K., you can think he's funny. He did a lot for comedy. He changed the comedy world.
It's true.
He's still a creep.
He's a creep.
He still used his power to manipulate women who he knew he had power over into uncomfortable situations.
Yes.
And by, like, I don't know, do I think Louis C.K. should, like, go to jail? No. He didn't do anything illegal. But what he did was messed up, and his power is what allowed him to do that.
And so he should be punished.
And the very thing that is stopping him from doing that is, like, people being upset.
There's, if you guys want to laugh a little bit and kind of make fun of Louis C.K., I would watch the first 20 minutes of Pete Davidson's stand-up act, because he tells a doozy of a story about him.
Oh, I don't know, it's like, it's hard because I try not to get myself too attached to celebrities because you, like, never know.
Yeah.
Like, but I do have celebrities that I'm very attached to, and, like, if stuff ever came out about them, I would be freaking devastated because I love their work and I love them.
Who's one of them?
Oh, Bo Burnham. Yeah. John Mulaney.
Oh my god, John Mulaney. I would, like, die.
I would die if John Mulaney came out and was, like, a rapist. I would just literally die.
I would be literally so upset, because that's, like 70% of what I watch.
I know, it would be so upsetting, but it's like, you have to make a choice. It's like, is John Mulaney's comedy worth the safety of women? No.
To our knowledge, John Mulaney has never committed a sex crime of any kind.
To our knowledge.
And we love him.
But if he did, I would have to, you have to make that choice. It's like, I love Oh Hello Baby. It's like one of my favorite freaking things to watch ever. I've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
I love John Mulaney. I watch the Sack Lunch Bunch. I watch all of that. But if it came out that John Mulaney had been abusing those little kids, How can I watch that? I can't. And I couldn't continue to give him my money. And maybe when he died, I could look back and think like, that was funny and he did a lot for comedy. But it's I think comedians are especially hard. Louis C.K. in particular is especially hard.
I was a huge Louis C.K.
because of his brand of comedy.
Yeah.
Where it's this like self-deprecating, oh, I'm such a pervert comedy. And it's then hard to look back at that when you know that he is a pervert. It's kind of like, oh, this is not funny.
Anymore. It's not funny when you know that he's an actual pervert.
Yeah, and it's like, I think comedians are kind of the hardest because they're not actors. Like, acting, it's a little easier.
Like, everything they say is a joke, right? Yeah. Whenever they're on stage, or what we know of them,
and
how they talk is like a joke.
Characters and all that stuff. But it's harder because they're using their own names. And they write it. And it's like, if I were to watch, like American Beauty, it's a little easier because I can think,
he's
like,
a character.
He's a character. He's not him. Even though it's like, okay, still gross. But, again, it's just like one of those, I think it's good to educate yourself and understand, like, that having a more complete picture of who a person is not bad.
It's always a good thing.
It's always a good thing. And it's good for us to understand that fame doesn't mean you're, like, flawless or guiltless. Like,
sometimes it exacerbates your flaws.
Sometimes it does. Oftentimes, I think.
Power.
People who want power, and I mean, this is not true of all artists in any way, but, or politicians or anything, but a lot of people that want power seek positions of power.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that are really charming and manipulative with large egos become actors, and those actors use those things to hurt people. And it's like, is that true of every actor? No. Some actors are great people who just love to act, and that's, mm-hmm. like, good for them. But it's not, you have to kind of send the message that certain things aren't okay. Mm-hmm. And if you send the message, and your money speaks way more than any amount of, like, what you say does.
Exactly. It's worth more than any Twitter post.
It's worth more than any Twitter post, just where your money goes. And if you say, no, I'm not, I love Kevin Spacey, he's my favorite actor, but I will not see a movie knowing that a studio hired him knowing he was a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
Then eventually, studios will say, well, we're not going to put Kevin Spacey in a movie.
Because no one's seeing it.
No one will see it because he's a pedophile. And then what that will do is it'll signal to other people who might be pedophiles or might want to be pedophiles that, hey, I can't use my position of power to abuse it like this. I can't do that. Because if it ever comes out, my career will be over. Mm-hmm. The thing that gives me the power will be over. And that's just something you have to understand.
Yeah, I agree.
Woof.
Woof. Long episode.
Long episode. Well, make up for last week.
Yes. Thank you, guys. All
right. Thanks, guys. Bye.